The following presentation was recorded at the Buddhist Society of Victoria, Malvern East, Australia. Please visit our website at bsv.net.au.
Okay, so let us start this evening. So, first question here. Dear Ajahn, we have learned that pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional here. And we know about the two arrows that the Buddha taught about. But if someone has chronic pain, disability, how can one constantly fight it or accept it? Thank you. It is hard when you have chronic pain. Yeah, it is not. It is difficult to deal with. But one of the ways is to try to manage the pain. And if there is some painkillers that you can use, it's okay to use painkillers. You don't have to kind of bear it all the time. So if there's some kind of medicine that helps you out, then use it. And often you can use it when you are on meditation retreats, yeah, unless it kind of makes your mind very blurry or very dull or whatever. You can use it when you do meditation just to support your meditation practice. And if you don't want to use it too much, then you can maybe not use it in ordinary life, for example. These things often become more intense when you meditate because there's nothing else to watch. So the pain kind of, there's no distractions. The pain can become very difficult. So then it might be useful to use this. Other thing you can do is to, this is kind of the standard way, is to try to accept the pain, yeah, and kind of not to try to avoid all that craving and desire to get rid of it. This is not easy to do, but if you can go down that track, you find actually the pain can become bearable. If you accept it, then mindfulness can arise, and then you can be able to just watch the breath and just kind of leave the pain to one side. Yeah, it is possible to do that, but it really depends on the strength of your mental qualities and all of these kind of things, whether you can do it or not. But that is kind of the ideal way, yeah, just to know that the pain is unavoidable, and ultimately, if it is unavoidable, okay, you have to accept it. There's no kind of two ways about it. You're just going to have to go with it somehow, and then bang, you make that breakthrough. And then when that happens, often the pain will subside as a consequence. Someone just told me the other day that they have this precise problem, and that they were able to accept it. And then when they accept it, the pain just decreased a lot. And straight away, they felt very much more peaceful and at ease with the whole thing. So it can be done. This letting go of the craving and desire to get rid of it. But there's nothing wrong with using medicines. Yeah, if you find something that can reduce it, often that is the kind of a good start, because that's what medicines are for. It's your good karma that you have good medicines. That's one nice way of thinking about it. But it's not easy. Yeah, and it certainly is a problem. So you just have to kind of do your best and see what happens. Okay, can you please give an example of a scallywag and how to cope with them? An example of a scallywag. Scallywags are like endearing people. Yeah, scallywag is a term of endearment. So when I use the term scallywag, it's kind of this is a nice term. Yeah, this is kind of these are the people you invite into your life, the scallywags. I'm not sure exactly what you mean by this, but if you mean someone who is difficult, in your life, and how to cope with people who are difficult, I've in a sense already talked about that quite a bit. There's lots of difficult people in life, and the only way to deal with them really, again, is this idea that to know that this is the way people are, and not to react to it, and have a sense of compassion. Yeah, if there are people with bad qualities and whatever, having compassion is always very powerful, because these people often suffer, they're causing trouble for themselves and others, and then compassion is often the right way of dealing with it. So that's what, that's if they are really That's what, you know, really bad people, not just scallywags, but bad, bad, bad. Yeah, that's what you do. Huh? But if they are scallywags, a scallywag is kind of someone who is a bit mischievous. Yeah, it's not really, it's not meant as a kind of, in a bad way. Yeah. It's a term that Ajahn Brahm uses when he sees what the monks do in the monastery. He calls us a bunch of scallywags. That's kind of we are scallywags. So this is, so I'm probably a good example of a scallywag. Yeah. So how do you cope with me? Well, that's how you cope with scallywags. So. Okay. Hello, Ajahn. Thank you for your wisdom. When one is in an environment where one is constantly at the receiving end, i.e. difficult boss, nasty spouse, etc. and one is not in a position to quit the job or to divorce, we can have compassion for those difficult people at times, but at other times it is very difficult to have empathy for them, as you are the one who always you're always the victim. What should one do so as to not react and generate wholesome karmas? You're not in a position to have a job and divorce, so you have to be around them. You're forced to be there, and you cannot have compassion. So what do you do then? Okay. So one of the things is to not have too much to do with them. To try to kind of reduce the contact is always a useful thing. Yeah, if you can. And one of the ways to do that is to kind of take a holiday every now and again. Come to the BSV, go on a retreat somewhere, get some distance. Because when you get distance, you get more clarity about what is going on. Then it's easier to see them in that way, to have compassion. If they are around you all the time and they're always kind of irritating you, it becomes very difficult to have compassion because it's just too close. The irritation is just too constant and becomes very hard. So make sure you get enough time for yourself. Okay, sorry, I gotta go and do my meditation now. Have a nice excuse, yeah? If it is a spouse that is problematic, then, you have to just tell them, okay, I need more time alone, And they will hopefully understand that and they will accept that. A boss at work, I don't know, again, you have to find some ways of not having too much contact, I suppose, however you can do that. But in the end, you have to come back to these ideas of perception, of understanding that difficult people, they are their own worst enemies. So you have to see them, try to see them that way. It is true, you cannot do it all the time, but you can incline more and more in that direction. That is really the trick here that you really have to come back to. So over time, it will get better and better and better. And eventually, you will be able to see them properly that way. The other thing is that you have to ask yourself, you say you're not in a position to divorce or quit your job, but maybe you are. Maybe you kind of feel trapped, but maybe sometimes you have to take a leap if things are too difficult. Sometimes you have to ask yourself whether that might be a better option for you anyway in the long run. Sometimes we think we can't do things, but actually it's surprising what you can do. Speak with some good friends, ask some other people who know your situation better what they would do in that situation. Talk it over with somebody you trust, see if you can find some kind of better way of dealing with this thing. Go to a counselor, go with your spouse to a counselor, say to them that it's just getting too difficult. Let's see if we can see a counselor together. And often counselors can be very useful because they often will have that neutral position. And then you will maybe be able to find out whether there's something you can do better or your spouse will be able to hear what they can do better. All of these things are possibilities. If you keep on looking for solutions, then the solutions will eventually arrive. Dear Ajahn, sometimes we may find it hard to balance helping in a skillful way and instead go to M&M's. M&M's, okay. That's chocolate, is that right? fix-it mode resulting in unhealthy... Okay, I'm not sure. Okay. Unhealthy codependency. How do we recognize this do-gooding in ourselves? Okay. So you end up with a kind of unhealthy codependency instead of actually helping and being doing things with kindness. Okay. So how do you recognize that? Well, you just you start somewhere. You just gradually find out. I mean, the fact that you are aware that there is something unhealthy going on means that you already have some insight. Yeah. So you try to kind of minimize the negative of these things. You try to, when you do an act of kindness, you try to look at your motivation more clearly, and you act more when there is that pure intention there. And if you feel that it is coming from some kind of unwholesome codependency or whatever, then maybe you'd kind of, you know, you withdraw a little bit more. You don't do it at times when you know it's coming from the wrong place and it doesn't really work out. Yeah, it's all about just looking at your motivation and applying the right action when you know the motivation is right. And if the motivation is dubious, then to not do it at those times. Yeah, so look at, that's really all it comes down to. The fact that you have insight into this already means that you are on the right track. You're heading in the right direction. So just keep on looking in that way and keep on trying to, you know, let go of the bad things and do things in the right way. And as you do that, it will kind of, hopefully, you come out of the problem. But again, sometimes these things, you need something more than the Dhamma to resolve difficult situations like that. And sometimes it is not a bad idea to go to someone who can be like, act like a kind of counselor to you. Yeah, someone who can kind of talk to you and find out, because they are neutral. And in your inner relationship, it is very, it's almost impossible to be neutral. You don't really know sometimes, you know, what is actually happening, because you're just too close to the action. And then having a third party that you can trust can be very useful to see clearly what is going on. So it's not kind of, you know, embarrassing or anything like that to have to go to a counselor. Sometimes it's actually a very wise thing to do, to emerge from difficulties of that sort. So sometimes if you rely too much on the Dhamma, it may not be the best way, yeah, because you may have a blind spot or something, and you may try to apply things, you don't really know what you're doing, and then, you know, coming to some using some third party can be very helpful. I don't know if there's anyone here in the BSV who kind of helps with these kind of things. Sometimes Buddhist organizations, they have kind of you know, they have services they provide for people. But anyway, wherever you can find some help, to can also be a useful thing to do. But if you are wise, you may also be able to kind of gradually extract yourself from that kind of situation by being wise about how you help others. Okay. Ajahn, you mentioned the Buddha said consciousness awareness is dukkha, and the highest state of liberation is when there is no consciousness. So how does one detach from consciousness? Does that mean you can't be aware when you have reached liberation? How you detach from consciousness, that is what I was just describing the other day. Yeah, I remember the other day I was talking about how you contemplate the five khandhas. Gradually, you go through the process of meditation, you watch your breath, and things gradually disappear. And part of the things that disappear as you go very deep through that meditation process, gradually, or even the conscious experience, is kind of, you're chipping away at it. It becomes less and less as you go deeper and deeper into your meditation practice. And that is how you become aware that conscious experience is dukkha, because the less conscious experience you have, the better it is. Yeah, the less that is going on, the more happy you are. Get rid of the five senses, the five sense consciousnesses of sight, hearing. All you're left with is the mind. When you go into very deep state of samadhi, you feel much better. So you know it's anicca because it's gone. You know it's dukkha because it feels better. And you know it's anatta because you can't access those consciousnesses when it gets very deep. So that's how you know it's dukkha. It's basically through the process of meditation, looking back upon the process, looking back upon things disappearing, and then you start to see what is going on. So that's how detachment comes gradually until eventually you have the big insights when you become a stream enter, yeah? Does it mean that you can't be aware when you reach liberation? Well, liberation means becoming an arahant. An arahant just means that you don't have any craving or attachment to these things. You still have awareness, but the attachment and the craving is gone. Yeah, and that is the point of this, we're talking about before, this two arrows or two darts. And the most problematic dart is the dart of the mind, where the mind is attaching and craving, and you suffer, first of all, through the body, or you suffer through, through the senses. And then the second one is the mind also kind of latching onto that and adding to the suffering by complaining or by taking it as an aspect of you and kind of making it a self thing out of it and all of this, making a view out of it or whatever. And that is when it becomes more problematic. But if the mind just lets go all the time and just sees it as a bad feeling without any kind of reaction to it, then the main part of the problem is gone. It's still going to be unpleasant, but it's going to be far less so if you do it that way. So you still have awareness, but your attitude to it is completely changed. So it's not a problem anymore here. Okay. Why does delusion and samsara exist? Why can't all beings be liberated as a natural state of being without having to go through dukkha and samsara? It's unfair. Beings are not liberated. It's bad. It's really unfair, isn't it? Why can't it be this way? We want it to be this way. We want this way. We crave for it to be this way. We don't want it to be any other way. Be careful of that, because if you crave for it to be that way, but it isn't that way, that is exactly how you create dukkha for yourself. We crave for the world to be different from what it actually is. Then you are really setting up big time dukkha. Since in the end it doesn't matter, and we are part of the same spirit or non-self. So why does delusion and samsara exist? This is kind of the sort of thing that the Buddha doesn't really give any answers to. Why? Because it's kind of irrelevant. Why it exists is kind of not really part of the equation. Well, one reason why it exists is because of craving. Because craving renews existence. So the reason why you are here, the reason why you are deluded, is because you were deluded in the past. So it is... delusion is this process that reinvents itself. It perpetuates itself from one existence to another one. Delusion creates more delusion. Delusion creates craving. Craving creates craving. So the reason why you are here, why you exist, why samsara exists, is because of past craving. But the point is, there is no first cause. Like we saw earlier on in this retreat, there is no initial point. So you can't really point to any beginning of all of this. This is how the Buddha... So there's just delusion in the past, going back indefinitely, craving before craving, That is really the only answer to this question, why it exists. And there is no first point. And actually, it is a very satisfactory way of thinking about the world, because we want to find first points. We want there to be a beginning of everything. But really, it doesn't make much sense to have a beginning. Because how can there be a beginning? Something must have created and made that beginning. Because how can something come out of nothing? That is the problem with having a beginning. Something coming out of nothing. Okay, so maybe one religion said, well, it's God created everything. But that's also not really satisfactory, because if God has always been there, you might as well have had the universe always been there. It's the same thing. It's the same idea. Doesn't really answer anything. So the problem remains the same. So to me, it is much more satisfactory conclusion to say, well, actually, it is all just cause and effect, and you cannot really find an initial point. You cannot even say it goes on forever, because that also you cannot see, but you cannot find a first point. It's just cause and effect going backwards, potentially indefinitely. And that is, to me, it's actually quite a satisfactory way of looking at the world. So for that reason, you cannot say anything about delusion and samsara, why it exists ultimately. You cannot answer that question. The Buddha doesn't reply to it. Why can't all beings be liberated as a natural state of being without having to go through dukkha and samsara? Again, this is kind of the wrong end of the stick from the Buddha's point of view, because we have a problem. And the question is, how do we resolve that problem? Yeah, if you crave for things to be different from what they are, all you are really doing is creating even more suffering for yourself. You're craving a reality that doesn't exist. And that, of course, is going to be very problematic. This is the point about Buddhism, is to try to see things according to reality and try to accept that reality and then deal with it to the best of your ability. The reality is that there is suffering, and this is the reality that the Buddha starts out with. And then he asks, is there a solution to the problem? And he finds that there is a solution, and that is really the good news. And then you start to try to find an end to the problem by using the Buddha's solution. So this is kind of, in one sense, it is a fairly kind of, the Buddhist doctrine is quite challenging, but on the other hand, it's also optimistic that there actually is a solution to the problem. You're not stuck with these things. If you gradually start to deal with these things, eventually you will find a solution. That is what really matters. Since in the end it doesn't matter and we're part of the same spirit or non-self. I'm not sure about that one. In the end it doesn't matter. I'm not sure what you mean by that. What doesn't matter in the end? Well, what matters is suffering. Yeah, you want to get out of suffering? So you deal with that. And that's really, that matters. Yeah, suffering matters, happiness matters. So you try to deal with those things. We are all part of the same spirit, are we? Not sure about that, if that's really the Buddhist kind of view of things, that we're part of the same spirit. The Buddhist view is more like you just end suffering. Yeah, you don't think of things in terms of being the same spirit. That's more like a Hindu view. Yeah, Advaita Vedanta, non-duality view, something like that. It's not really a Buddhist way of looking at things. Okay, so we'll go on to the next one. If you're not happy with any of these answers, then please feel free to try again tomorrow. And I will try my best to see if I can improve on last night's, the previous answer. Dear Ajahn, are there other meditation techniques that we need to do after Anapanasati? Relaxation, then non-directional mindfulness to gradual directional mindfulness of breath to Anapanasati. Is there anything after? You can take, this is the thing, Anapanasati can take you all the way to awakening, says the Buddha. So you can use that technique all the way to awakening. I haven't looked at the Anapanasati Sutta this time. Maybe I should have done that. Maybe we should look at that every time, because it's a very nice sutta. And it gives you the instruction on how to use mindfulness of breathing all the way to the end of the path. So the humble breath is pretty powerful. This breath that is always there, it seems like such an ordinary thing. It's very unmystical and ordinary, which is one of the nice things about using the breath as your meditation. It's a very natural process. So the point is that you use your breath. And if you are successful in the breath meditation, it will take you through a large number of stages. This is really what it is about. So there comes something after, if you like, but it's really more of the breath. But the breath looked at from different kind of perspectives. So first of all, if you get the breath meditation right, first of all, you tend to calm down. You become more peaceful. Then you see more of the breath. It's like your mindfulness expands. You see the whole breath. And then it calms down more. And as you keep on mindfulness expanding, as you keep on seeing more of the breath, there comes a point when you start to feel pleasure. You start to feel pamuja, piti, sukha, all of these beautiful feelings. Why is that? The reason is because you become very peaceful and the defilements are starting to fade away. This is what happens when you become peaceful. You're no longer feeding the defilements of the mind by thinking in the wrong way. And when you reach a state of natural purity, it is natural for bliss and happiness to start to arise. Yeah. And then you are with the breath, and it becomes very beautiful at this point, very attractive. It's almost as if you really want to be with the breath because it's so nice. So then you carry on, yeah, the bliss starting to arise. Then the bliss becomes more and more refined. The peace becomes even greater. These are the two characteristics of good meditation experiences. The peace becoming more and more profound. The joy and happiness also becoming deeper and deeper as you go along. These are the two ways that you know that you're heading in the right direction in your meditation. Yeah? The amount of peace you have and the amount of bliss or happiness that you have. And the breath is always there. Sometimes the bliss becomes so strong that even the breath kind of disappears a bit in the background. But the breath is always like the anchor that you come back to. Yeah? And then you take it even further, and there comes a point when you start to let go of the body even more. Yeah? The senses start to really fade away, and you're left just with the mind. And that mind image is often what they call it's like a bright light sometimes that you can see in the mind's eye, often called a nimitta. But a nimitta is not really that's not what it's called in the sutta. So it's called something like an obasa, like a splendor or something like that. So and then it becomes. At this point, it becomes incredibly, incredibly blissful and still. Yeah, and then you take that too, deeper and deeper and deeper, more and more bliss, more and more stillness. That's really the critical thing, more bliss and more stillness as you move through this process. The breath may still be there in the background, now becoming very weak. The main focus point now becomes that nimitta that you have, that light you have. Yeah, and eventually, you take that all the way into deep samadhi states like the jhanas. This is where you're heading to. And the breath does all of that. Yeah, all of that can be done with the breath. And then when you come out of these very deep meditation, depending on how deep it is, then you come to the things I was talking about the other day. When you review your experience, you look at the things that have faded away. Everything in your experience is the five khandhas. So everything that you then review is actually the five khandhas. You see how they gradually fade away. You see their impermanence, first of all, how they fade away, how they cease. Yeah, and then ultimately, through seeing that enough, then you have this reaction called patanissaga, which is like giving these things up completely, and then craving ends as a consequence. So breath is very useful. You can take it all the way. But it's not the only thing that you should be doing. You should be doing other things as well to support it. And the kind of typical things to do is things like do a bit of metta. Metta also, of course, is a daily life, but you can also try to bring it a bit into your meditation practice, the loving kindness meditation. You can do a bit of death contemplation, or you can do any kind of contemplation that has long Dhamma lines. But these are all things that are powerful. Death contemplation is powerful. Remind yourself you're going to die. Remind yourself you don't know when it's going to be here. How does that affect your mind? We tried to do that yesterday with a death contemplation. I don't know if it worked for you, but if it works, you should start to feel very empty and peaceful inside. It may not give rise to bliss necessarily, but you can feel very peaceful by doing the death contemplation in the right way. So add to these things, because you can't watch the breath all the time. As I said yesterday, sometimes the meditation comes to a natural end, and then you need to do something else. Do a bit of walking. Just enjoy the peace and quiet. Do some contemplation. Do whatever. So you have a bit of variety in your meditation practice. Okay. Dear Ajahn, we were talking in the morning about non-self as a way to break the cycle of dependent origination. I thought that feeling and attabhava is really eliminated only by the anagami stage. That feeling of attabhava. Okay, attabhava, okay? At the anagami stage. So how to get rid of this illusion of self to progress further on the path? Many thanks. Well, it's like everything, yeah. All of these illusions, yeah, the feeling of a self and all of this, they are also gradually eliminated. It's not, it is true that there comes a point when it kind of, you have the big bang, you know, it's really kind of, you see through it thoroughly, but also just through your ordinary meditation experience, you are eliminated some of that sense of self, yeah, the identity that we have to all of these things, you are actually letting go of that. Why? Well, because you're becoming peaceful. And in that peaceful mind, there is less identity. A lot of the way that the identity expresses itself is through the thinking and through justifying and to kind of thinking about who you are and what you are in relationship to others and all of this. When you become very peaceful, it's as if that identity is largely gone. You're just peaceful. Yeah, you're nothing, just empty, empty inside. And what does it feel like? It feels nice. Yeah, identity is a problem. Yeah, you start to see that as in already in your meditation practice. So it is a gradual thing. Yeah, that you deepen and deepen. The deeper you go, if you enter a deep state of samadhi, there's very little identity left. And this is one of the reasons why it is fairly easy at that point to become a stream entry, because you have already given up so much of your identity as part of that process. Yeah, this is why you can see so much of non-self just by doing the process of samatha in the right way. You look back on the process, you understand a lot of what non-self is about already. Yeah, so you are giving up these things strongly already just through the ordinary process of meditation. You are reducing it already. So all along, avidya is kind of becoming less until you have given it up in the to a large extent, yeah? And then one day the mind is so peaceful that you are ready to have a big insight experience. And that's when you become a stream entry. Yeah, that's when you see the full non-self. One thing is to reduce it and to kind of make it less. Another thing is to see it completely. That's when you really have this big flash. Yeah, boy, now I really understand. And that's when you overturn things completely. And that happens at stream entry. That's what stream entry is all about, seeing non-self fully. Yes, there is still the feeling left. There is still conceit. Yeah, this is called conceit in the suttas. That conceit, that mana or whatever, that goes with you all the way to arahantship to some extent. And what that means is that your habits of thinking in terms of yourself will still be there to some extent, all the way to you become an arahant. But your view is correct. So if someone asks you, yeah, you know that there is no inherent essence in you, yeah, but you will still sometimes be deluded by these things. So then you keep on practicing. But once you are a stream mentor, you don't have to worry about how to practice. Once you are a stream mentor, it happens all automatically. You know the path is part of who you are. You just follow that, carry on that path, and eventually you just overcome everything as a consequence. That's how you just get rid of it. That's how you do it, yeah? Become peaceful, get into a good state of samadhi, already overcome all of this thing, then reflect back on the process you have been through, and eventually, if you reflect back on that process, and if you keep on doing that, one day, bang, you become a stream entry. Sovan, sotapanna, yeah? And then carry on after that, practicing that same path more and more, and then one day, you're arahant. Oops, arahant now. Gee, arahant. Okay, what happened? And it's a bit like that, yeah, because the path sort of happens by itself. So one day you kind of wonder, gee, that's interesting. And then you look back and you're very pleased with yourself. Actually, not really pleased with yourself, because you're an arahant, yeah? So you kind of just, okay, now I'm happy. Okay, a few more questions to go. So, dear Ajahn, you said in the suttas, the Buddha said, mindfulness is not enough. What are all the other steps to be liberated and awake? How do we become more mindful in meditation? Well, I said that in the specific connection of overcoming ill will, yeah? So mindfulness, to overcome ill will, you need to have mindfulness, but you also need to have metta. Metta is the way to overcome ill will. And metta, again, is not just done in meditation. It is what we do throughout our daily life, how we're learning to think about people in the right way. It's very interesting that in the suttas, actually we come to the sutta later on, the Buddha says that to overcome bad conduct, the right way to do that is to reflect in the right way. You don't overcome bad conduct, even mental bad conduct, by meditation practice. You do it by learning how to think in the right way. Yeah? Thinking about people, thinking about situations in a wise way. Wisdom power, yeah? And that is also how you can have metta towards others. So with mindfulness, you cannot overcome ill will. You have to have metta. So that's what I was referring to at that point. But yes, it is certainly true that you need more than mindfulness, not only to overcome ill will, but for everything on the path, you need that. Yeah. What are the other steps to be liberated and awake? Well, first of all, the Eightfold Path. Yeah, that's the other steps. So first of all, you need all the other things to support mindfulness. Mindfulness without support is going to be weak. So you need to have support, and that support is, again, sila. Two things that support mindfulness, and you see that in many, many places in the suttas, sila and right view. Yeah, Ujjukaditti and sila are the two things that you need to support mindfulness. You go to the Satipatthana Sanghita that has all the discourses on Satipatthana practice, and they say specifically that you practice Satipatthana based on these two foundations, sila and Ujjukaditti. Ujjukaditti means straight view or right view. If you look at the Noble Eightfold Path, it begins with right view, and then you have the right aim or the right purpose, and then you have all the sila factors, including right effort. Then you have Satipatthana. Yeah, so the two things there are really just sila and right view, also within the Noble Eightfold Path. And if you start to look at the suttas, you will see this is a recurring theme everywhere. Yeah, so always the answer is that if your meditation isn't going well enough, what is the reason? The reason is not that you are watching the breath in the wrong way. I mean, the breath is, it's very simple to watch the breath. Yeah, you just watch it. There's no big deal. You can't really watch the breath in many different ways. If you are ready, you will know exactly how to watch the breath. It will be automatic. It won't be very hard. So if you can't do it, or it is difficult for you, this is where you have to look. Sila and right view. Yeah, this is really what it's about. Why? Well, because if you have very strong sila, if you have a very pure, if you are a very pure heart, you are not going to be part of that purity of heart. Is that you don't have much ill will. You have a lot of metta and compassion instead. You don't have too much desires, because you understand that all those desires are just problematic. So you have those left aside. And if you don't have too much desire and ill will, it means that you're already largely in the present. Yeah, you are here. You're not kind of in the future or in the past. If you have a lot of ill will and desire, your mind is going to be drawn to the future and the past. So if you look at your mind during meditation, the thinking mind is that kind of mind which is drawn to the present and the past usually. It is driven by desires, maybe not strong desires, but desires nonetheless, and maybe subtle ill will or whatever. That is why it doesn't work out. So there is there an opportunity to purify your sila more. And then the mind comes into the present moment. You feel good about yourself. It is natural to feel good about yourself if you have good morality. Then when you feel good about yourself, you're happy in the present moment. Yeah, wow, it's nice to be here. I feel good about myself. Yay, yeah. You try not to think yay because that's another thought, but you kind of, you know what I mean here. And then you feel good about yourself, and then you have mindfulness, and then it happens. You are just here, and then watching the breath is just automatic. You can't really avoid it anymore because you're here already. The breath is here. You are here. It happens. Mindfulness just goes on. This is how it works. This is why sila is so important as a foundation for watching the breath or for any meditation of it. You feel good about yourself. You're naturally present. If you look at how the Buddha explains meditation in so many places, I'd mentioned this before, the anusati is the recollections. The recollections are all about how to feel happy. And one of the most important recollections is the sila anusati, recollection of your virtue, yeah, your good qualities, or chaga anusati, your generosity. And these things are all about your character and how you live and your sila and these things. The other aspect is right view, yeah, because right view means that you understand where to look for happiness. You understand where to avoid suffering, and the more you understand that, the more the mind will just automatically go to that and won't be interested in the other things. This is why right view is so important. This is why right view is much more than just believing in rebirth and karma. It is about understanding the kind of this nature of samsaric existence, understanding why sensual pleasures or attachment to things in the world are inherently problematic. The more you get that, the more you allow yourself to kind of follow along with the Buddha in that area, the less interested you will have in those things. But it's very gradual. Yeah, it's not easy to see this. It takes time, so you have to be very patient with yourself. So these are the main things that support liberation or support mindfulness. But then to really be liberated, you have to apply that mindfulness to your meditation object. And when you apply the mindfulness in the right way, the mind becomes very still and peaceful. And then you can enter samadhi experiences. Samadhi is the last factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. And if you want to reach any state of awakening, you're going to need some sort of samadhi to be able to do that. Otherwise, it's not going to work. So that is the last one. The whole Eightfold Path has to come together. Yeah, then you are getting there. Yeah? How do we become more mindful in meditation? Okay, you got the answer. Yeah. So, specifically try to use those anusattis, those recollections, a little bit, and see if you can bring up a more peaceful mind. Yeah, use the death contemplation a little bit, all of these things, and hopefully that will support that mindfulness. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmali, in keeping with the theme of the Second Noble Truth, would Ajahn Nisarana mind telling us the story of Nasruddin looking for the keys to his house in the front yard? Okay. Thank you doesn't capture the gratitude evoked, but thank you so much for coming to visit us in Melbourne and for your endless and incomparable wisdom. Okay. And a big thank you to Ajahn Nisarana for his presence here and over the last few months. Absolutely beyond value. Okay, well, there you are. You want to tell the story of Nasruddin who's lost his keys? Again? Okay, I don't know that story. I think you know. Do I? Okay, maybe I know the one about eating chilies, but I... that's another story. Yeah.
Actually, I think I can ask other people to tell the story because they've probably heard it so many times because I use it a lot. But the story is as people have heard it before, Nasruddin was outside his house one evening and he was looking on the ground, he's looking around and his neighbour came out and said, "What are you looking for, Nasruddin?" And Nasruddin said, "I'm looking for the key to my house." And the neighbour said, "Don't worry, I will help you." And so they both looked for the key to the house under the street light. And they looked and looked and looked and couldn't find it. So the neighbour said to Nasruddin, as people generally do, "Do you know where you lost it?" And Nasruddin, of course, being Nasruddin, said, "Yes, I know where I lost it." And the neighbour said, "Where?" And he said, "In the house." And the neighbour said, "Why are we looking out here?" And those friends said, "Ah, the light's so much better out here." And the house, how I interpret it, the house is like the mind, the heart. And that's where we need to look inside ourselves, not outside under the street lamp. This is where the five senses are. This is where we're used to being because the light's so good and also we're so used to it. So we tend to go to it, even though we tend to know that the key is actually inside the house. It always has been. And the enjoyment, the happiness we get from the five senses actually coming from us, not from the objects. We are actually making ourselves happy using that object as a trigger. So this is where the looking for the key that Nasruddin is talking about. For me, that's the meaning of it. We're looking for happiness, as Bhante calls it, in the right place. Instead of the wrong place, out on the street, out in the five senses. So that's my story. And I think a lot of people like that story a lot. So it's meaningful for me and I hope for others too. So there we go. Nasruddin comes into everything. Can't escape. In fact, people say to me, "Bhante, you didn't mention Nasruddin this time." No talk is complete without some Nasruddin story. There we are. Thank you. There we are. There we are.
Okay, so that is, are you happy? That is the story, that's the written story. Okay, that's good. Okay, last question for tonight. As follows, dear Ajahn, how should one do the daily practice on the cushion? Is it anapanasati, body scanning, choiceless awareness, manasati, contemplation on death, qualities of Buddha metta, or a mixture of all the above? Could you please do a guided meditation on the ideal way for faster penetration into ultimate reality? Okay, gee, well, that's okay. That, so you really want to get your money's worth, right, on this retreat? So, what you should do in your daily practice, remember, usually when you go on retreat, that's usually when you have a chance to kind of take the meditation a bit deeper. It is quite hard in daily life to expect the same kind of results as you have in a retreat. So do retreats every now and again to see how your, you know, how your general progress is in your life. And in daily life, what I would recommend you to do, if you want to do a bit of meditation, use it just to relax and to enjoy and to kind of maybe do a bit of metta practice or whatever. The idea of meditation in daily life, I think, should mostly be to support you, to enable you to have good virtue throughout the day. Yeah, if you start the day in a good way with a bit of meditation, you have a bit of metta towards people, or you at least you feel good about yourself because you are relaxed and you are at ease. Yeah, you don't feel stressed and all these kind of things. Stress is one of the worst things for being able to be nice. How can you be nice to others if you feel stressed? It's really hard. You get short-tempered when you're stressed, and it's very difficult to be kind to people around you. So use it just to chillax, yeah? The Buddha didn't use that word, but you know, you use that word to just to relax a little bit, and then you have more time for other people because you have more time for yourself. Look after yourself in this way, and that is really, I think, the best way to use the daily practice. Don't force yourself to sit for long periods of time. Make it into something pleasant in the daily life. If you don't feel like sitting, don't do it. Yeah, if you try for 5 minutes, it doesn't work, okay, just get up and do something else, because it's supposed to be something that enhances your daily life and your feeling of your ability to actually live well. So that's what I would recommend. And then you can do a little bit of these things that you suggest here, yeah, maranasati or metta, but ask yourself whether it adds quality to your daily life. If it adds quality, then these things are good to do. Anapanasati may be too much to ask for during daily life. Yeah, it takes quite a while even to settle down. Sometimes it can take people a day or two coming on retreat before they're able to even watch the breath, because it takes, you know, the mind takes a long time sometimes to settle down. So sometimes just relax. Sometimes do present moment awareness. Do a little bit of contemplation or whatever. Sometimes don't do anything. Just put on a bit of music and, you know, relax. And if any of these things are okay. So knowing the result is the most important thing. Know why you're doing things. And once you know why you're doing things, then you can gauge whether the method is getting you to that result. That is kind of the critical part here. So guided meditation on the ideal way for faster penetration into ultimate reality. Yeah, well, that's just watch your breath. Yeah, that's really all it is. And then bang, ultimate reality just appears on the screen and eventually. And that's kind of the way to get there. That's the fast way. It's not very fast, but it's the fastest. Okay, that's all for tonight. So again, have a good rest, and we'll see you back again tomorrow morning. Let's do the Arahang Sammasambuddha together.